Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This story is written by Bertram Chandler. Its title is The Cage, and it first appeared in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction of June 1957. Imprisonment is always a humiliating experience, no matter how philosophical the prisoner. Imprisonment by one's own kind is bad enough, but one can at least talk to one's captors. One can make one's wants understood. One can, on occasion, appeal to them, man to man. Imprisonment is doubly humiliating when one's captors, in all honesty, treat one as a lower animal. The party from the survey ship could perhaps be excused for failing to recognize the survivors from the interstellar liner Lodestar as rational beings. At least 200 days had passed since their landing on the planet without a name, an unintentional landing made when Lodestar's Aranhaf generators, driven far in excess of their normal capacity by breakdown of the electronic regulator, had flung her far from the regular shipping lanes to an unexplored region of space. Lodestar had landed safely enough, but shortly thereafter, troubles never come singly, her pile had got out of control and her captain had ordered his first mate to evacuate the passengers and such crew members not needed to cope with the emergency and to get them as far from the ship as possible. Hawkins and his charges were well clear when there was a flare of released energy, a not very violent explosion. The survivors wanted to turn to watch, but Hawkins drove them on with curses and at times blows. Luckily, they were upwind from the ship and so escaped the fallout. When the fireworks seemed to be over, Hawkins, accompanied by Dr. Boyle, the ship's surgeon, returned to the scene of the disaster. The two men, wary of radioactivity, were cautious and stayed a safe distance from the shallow, still-smoking crater that marked where the ship had been. It was all too obvious to them that the captain, his officers and technicians, were now no more than an infinitesimal part of the incandescent cloud that had mushroomed up into the low overcast. Thereafter, the 50-odd men and women, the survivors of Lodestar, had degenerated. It hadn't been a fast process. Hawkins and Boyle, aided by a committee of the more responsible passengers, had fought a stout rearguard action, but it had been a hopeless sort of fight. The climate was against them for a start. Hot it was, always in the neighborhood of 85 degrees Fahrenheit, and it was wet, a thin, warm drizzle falling all the time. The air seemed to abound with the spores of fungi. Luckily, these did not attack living skin, but throve on dead organic matter and clothing. They throve to a slightly lesser degree on metals and on the synthetic fabrics that many of the castaways wore. Danger, outside danger, would have helped to maintain morale. But there were no dangerous animals. There were only little smooth-skinned things, not unlike frogs, that hopped through the sodden undergrowth and in the numerous rivers, fish-like creatures that ranged in size from the shark to the tadpole, and all of them possessing the bellicosity of the latter. Food had been no problem after the first few hungry hours. Volunteers had tried a large, succulent fungus growing on the boles of the huge, fern-like trees. They had pronounced it good. After a lapse of 5 hours, they had neither died nor even complained of abdominal pains. That fungus was to become the staple diet of the castaways. In the weeks that followed, other fungi had been found, and berries and roots, all of them edible. They provided a welcome variety. Fire, in spite of the all-pervading heat, fire was the blessing most missed by the castaways. With it, they could have supplemented their diet by catching and cooking the little frog-like things of the rainforest, the fishes of the streams. Some of the hardier spirits did eat these animals raw, but they were frowned upon by most of the other members of the community. And too, fire would have helped to drive back the darkness of the long nights, would by its real warmth and light have dispelled the illusion of cold produced by the ceaseless dripping of water from every leaf frond. When they fled from the ship, most of the survivors had possessed pocket lighters, but the lighters had been lost when the pockets, together with the clothing surrounding them, had disintegrated. In any case, all attempts to start a fire in the days when there were still pocket lighters had failed. There was not, Hawkins swore, a single dry spot on the whole accursed planet. Now the making of fire was quite impossible. Even if there had been present an expert on the rubbing together of two dry sticks, he could have found no material with which to work. They made their permanent settlement on the crest of a low hill. There were, so far as they could discover, no mountains. It was less thickly wooded there than the surrounding plains, and the ground was less marshy underfoot. They succeeded in wrenching fronds from the fern-like trees and built for themselves crude shelters, more for the sake of privacy than for any comfort that they afforded. And they clung with a certain desperation to the governmental forms of the worlds that they had left and elected themselves a council. Boyle, the ship's surgeon, was their chief. Hawkins, rather to his surprise, was returned as a council member by a majority of only 2 votes. On thinking it over, he realized that many of the passengers must still bear a grudge against the ship's executive staff for their present predicament. The first council meeting was held in a hut, if so it could be called, especially constructed for the purpose. The council members squatted in a rough circle. Boyle, the president, got slowly to his feet. Hawkins grinned wryly as he compared the surgeon's nudity with the pomposity that he seemed to have assumed with his elected rank, as he compared the man's dignity with the unkempt appearance presented by his uncut, uncombed gray hair, his uncombed and straggling gray beard. Boyle began.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hawkins looked around him at the naked, pallid bodies, at the stringy, lusterless hair, and the long, dirty fingernails of the men and the unpainted lips of the women. He thought, I don't suppose I look much like an officer and a gentleman myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been, as you know, elected to represent the human community upon this planet. I suggest that at this, our first meeting, we discuss our chances of survival not as individuals but as a race.
I'd like to ask Mr. Hawkins what our chances are of being picked up,
shouted one of the 2 women members, a dried-up, spinsterish creature with prominent ribs and vertebrae. And then Hawkins said,
Slim, as you know, no communication is possible with other ships or with planet stations when the interstellar drive is operating. When we snapped out of the drive and came in for our landing, we sent out a distress call, but we couldn't say where we were. Furthermore, we don't know that the call was received.
Miss Taylor and Mr. Hawkins, I would remind you that I am the duly elected president of this council. I believe there will be time later for a general discussion. Now, as most of you may already have assumed, the age of this planet, biologically speaking, corresponds roughly with that of Earth during the Carboniferous era. As we already know, no species yet exists to challenge our supremacy. By the time such a species does emerge, something analogous to the giant lizards of Earth's Triassic era, we should be well established.
We shall be dead.
We shall be dead, but our descendants will be very much alive. We have to decide how to give them as good a start as possible. Language we shall bequeath to them.
Never mind the language, Doc,
called the other woman member. She was a small blonde, slim, with a hard face.
It's just this question of descendants that I'm here to look after. I represent the women of childbearing age. There are, as you know, 15 of us here. So far, the girls have been very, very careful. We have reason to be. Can you, as a medical man, guarantee, bearing in mind that you have no drugs, no instruments, safe deliveries, can you guarantee that our children will have a good chance of survival?
Well, Miss Hart, I'll be frank. I have not, as you pointed out, either drugs or instruments, but I can assure you that your chances of a safe delivery are far better than they would have been on Earth during, well, let's say, the 18th century. And I'll tell you why. On this planet, Miss Hart, so far as we know, and we've been here long enough now to find out the hard way, on this planet there exist no microorganisms harmful to man. Now, if such organisms did exist, the bodies of those of us still surviving would be by this time mere masses of superation. And most of us, of course, would have died of septicemia long ago. And, well, I think that answers both your questions.
I haven't finished yet. Here's another point. There are 53 of us here, men and women. There are 10 married couples, so we'll count them out. That leaves 33 people, of whom 20 are men. 20 men to 13 women. Aren't we girls always unlucky? All of us aren't young, but we're all of us women. What sort of marriage setup do we have? Monogamy? Polyandry?
Monogamy, of course,
said a tall, thin man sharply. He was the only one of those present who wore clothing, if so it could be called. The disintegrating fronds lashed around his waist with a strand of vine did little to serve any useful purpose.
All right, then. Monogamy. I'd rather prefer it that way myself. But I warn you that if that's the way we play it, there's going to be trouble. And in any murder involving passion and jealousy, the woman is as liable to be a victim as either of the men, and I don't want that.
Well, what exactly do you propose, then, Miss Hart?
Just this, Doc. When it comes to our matings, we leave love out of it. If two men want to marry the same woman, then let them fight it out. The best man gets the girl and keeps her.
I see. Yes, natural selection. I'm in favor, but we must put it to the vote.
At the crest of the low hill was a shallow depression, a natural arena. Round the rim sat the castaways, all but four of them. One of the four was Dr. Boyle. He had discovered that his duties as president embraced those of a referee. It had been held that he was the best competent to judge when one of the contestants was liable to suffer permanent damage. Another of the four was the girl, Mary Hart. She had found a serrated twig with which to comb her long hair. She had contrived a wreath of yellow flowers with which to crown the victor. Was it, wondered Hawkins as he sat with the other council members, was it a hankering after an earthly wedding ceremony? Or was it a harking back to something older and darker?
A pity these blasted molds got on our watches,
said the fat man on Hawkins' right.
If we had any means of telling the time, we could have rounds, make a proper prize fight of it.
Hawkins nodded. He looked at the four in the center of the arena, at the strutting, barbaric woman, at the pompous old man, at the two dark-bearded young men with their glistening white bodies. He knew them both. Fennett had been a senior cadet of the ill-fated Lodestar. Clemens, at least 7 years Fennett senior, was a passenger, had been a prospector on the frontier worlds.
If we had anything to bet with, I'd lay it on Clemens. That cadet of yours hasn't a snowball's chance in hell. He's been brought up to fight clean. Clemens has been brought up to fight dirty. Fennett's in better condition. He's been taking exercise, while Clemens has been just laying around, sleeping and eating. Look at that paunch on him. There's nothing wrong with good, healthy flesh and muscle.
Now, remember, no gouging, no biting, and may the best man win.
The doctor stepped back smartly from the contestants and stood with the Hart woman. There was an air of embarrassment about the pair of them as they stood there, each with his fists hanging at his sides. Each seemed to be regretting that matters had come to such a pass.
Go on! Don't you want me? You'll live to a ripe old age here, and it'll be lonely with no woman.
Yeah, they can always wait around till your daughters grow up, Mary.
If I ever have any daughters, I shan't at this rate.
Fennett made a start. He stepped forward almost diffidently, dabbed with his right fist at Clemens' unprotected face. It wasn't a heart blow, but it must have been painful. Clemens put his hand up to his nose, brought it away, and stared at the bright blood staining it. He growled, lumbered forward with arms open to hug and crush. The cadet danced back, scoring twice more with his right.
Why doesn't he hit him and break every bone in his fist? They aren't wearing gloves, you know.
Fennett decided to make a stand. He stood firm, his feet slightly apart, and brought his right into play once more. This time, he left his opponent's face alone, went for his belly instead. Hawkins was surprised to see that the prospector was taking the blows with apparent equanimity. He must be, he decided, much tougher in actuality than in appearance. The cadet sidestepped smartly and slipped on the wet grass. Clemens fell heavily onto his opponent. Hawkins could hear the whoosh as the air was forced from the lad's lungs. The prospector's thick arms encircled Fennett's body, and Fennett's knee came up viciously to Clemens' groin. The prospector squealed but hung on grimly. One of his hands was around Fennett's throat now, and the other one, its fingers viciously hooked, was clawing for the cadet's eyes.
No gouging, I said. No gouging.
He dropped down to his knees, caught Clemens' thick wrist with both his hands. Something made Hawkins look up then. It may have been a sound, although this is doubtful. The spectators were behaving like boxing fans at a prize fight. They could hardly be blamed. This was the first piece of real excitement that had come their way since the loss of the ship. It may have been a sound that made Hawkins look up. It may have been the sixth sense possessed by all good spacemen. What he saw made him cry out. Hovering above the arena was a helicopter. There was something about the design of it, a subtle oddness that told Hawkins that this was no earthly machine. And suddenly, from its smooth, shining belly dropped a net, seemingly of dull metal. It enveloped the struggling figures on the ground, trapped the doctor and Mary Hart. Hawkins shouted again, a wordless cry. He jumped to his feet, ran to the assistance of his ensnared companions. The net seemed to be alive. It twisted itself around his wrists, bound his ankles. Others of the castaways rushed to aid Hawkins.
Keep away! Scatter!
The low drone of the helicopter's rotors rose in pitch. The machine lifted. In an incredibly short space of time, the arena was to the first mate's eyes no more than a pale green saucer in which little white ants scurried aimlessly. Then the flying machine was above and through the base of the low clouds, and there was nothing to be seen but drifting whiteness. When at last it made its descent, Hawkins was not surprised to see the silvery tower of a great spaceship standing among the low trees on a level plateau. The world to which they were taken would have been a marked improvement on the world they had left had it not been for the mistaken kindness of their captors. The cage in which the three men were housed duplicated with remarkable fidelity the climatic conditions of the planet upon which Lodestar had been lost. It was glassed in, and from sprinklers in its roof fell a steady drizzle of warm water. A couple of dispirited tree ferns provided little shelter from the depressing precipitation. Twice a day, a hatch at the back of the cage, which was made of a sort of concrete, opened, and slabs of a fungus remarkably similar to that on which they had been subsisting were thrown in. There was a hole in the floor of the cage. This, the prisoners rightly assumed, was for sanitary purposes. On either side of them were other cages. In one of them was Mary Hart, alone. She could gesture to them, wave to them, and that was all. The cage on the other side held a beast built on the same general lines as a lobster, but with a strong hint of squid. Across the broad roadway, they could see other cages, but could not see what they housed. Hawkins, Boyle, and Fennett sat on the damp floor and stared through the thick glass and the bars at the beings outside who stared at them.
Well, if only they were humanoid, if only they were the same shape as we are, we might make a start towards convincing them that we, too, are intelligent beings, Hawkins.
They aren't the same shape. And we, were the situations reversed, would take some time convincing that three six-legged beer barrels were men and brothers. Try Pythagoras's theorem again.
Without enthusiasm, Fennett broke fronds from the nearest tree fern. He broke them into smaller pieces, then on the mossy floor laid them out in the design of a right-angled triangle with squares constructed on all three sides. The natives, a large one, one slightly smaller, and a little one, regarded him incuriously with their flat, dull eyes. The large one put the tip of a tentacle into a pocket, the things wore clothing, and pulled out a brightly colored packet. Handed it to the little one. The little one tore off the wrapping, started stuffing pieces of some bright blue confection into the slot on its upper side that obviously served it as a mouth.
I wish they were allowed to feed the animals. I'm sick of that damned fungus.
Now, let's recapitulate. After all, we've nothing else to do. We were taken from our camp by the helicopter, six of us. We're taken to the survey ship, a vessel that seemed in no way superior to our own interstellar ships. And you assure us, Hawkins, that the ship used the Ehrenhaft drive with something so close to it as to be its twin brother.
Correct.
Now, on the ship, we've been kept in separate cages. There's no ill treatment. We're fed and watered at frequent intervals. We land on this strange planet, but we see nothing of it. We're hustled out of cages like so many cattle into a covered van. We know that we're being driven somewhere, that's all. The van stops, the door opens, and a couple of these animated beer barrels poke in poles with smaller additions of those fancy nets on the end of them. And they catch Clemens and Miss Taylor, drag them out, and we never see them again. The rest of us spend the night and the following day and night in individual cages. The next day we're taken to this zoo.
Do you think they were vivisected? I never liked Clemens, Doc, but
I am afraid they were, Fennett. Our captors must have learned of the difference between the sexes by it. Unluckily, there's no way of determining intelligence by vivisection.
Oh, the filthy brutes.
Easy, son. You can't blame them, you know. We've vivisected animals a lot more like us than we are to these things.
The problem is to convince these things, as you call them, Hawkins, to convince them that we are rational beings like themselves. How would they define a rational being? How would we define a rational being?
Maybe somebody who knows Pythagoras' theorem?
I read somewhere that the history of man is the history of the fire-making, tool-using animal.
Then make fire and make us some tools and use them.
Don't be silly. You know that there's not an artifact among the bunch of us. No false teeth, even, and not even a metal filling. Even so, when I was a youngster, there was, among the cadets in the interstellar ships, a revival of the old arts and crafts. We considered ourselves in a direct line of descent from the old windjammer sailormen, so we learned how to splice rope and wire, how to make sennit and fancy knots and all the rest of it. Then, one of us hit on the idea of basket making. We were in a passenger ship, and we used to make our baskets secretly, daub them with violent colors, and sell them to passengers as genuine souvenirs from the lost planet of Arcturus the Sixth. There was a most distressing scene when the old man and the mate found out.
What are you driving at, Hawkins?
Just this. We will demonstrate our manual dexterity by the weaving of baskets. I'll teach you how.
Well, it might work. It just might work. On the other hand, remember that certain birds and animals do the same sort of thing. On Earth, there's the beaver who makes quite cunning dams, and there's the bower bird who makes a bower for his mate as part of the courtship ritual.
The headkeeper must have known of creatures whose courting habits resembled those of the Terran bower bird. After 3 days of feverish basket making, which consumed all the bedding and stripped the tree ferns, Mary Hart was taken from her cage and put in with the three men. After she had got over her hysterical pleasure at having somebody to talk to again, she was rather indignant. It was good, thought Hawkins drowsily, to have Mary with them. A few more days of solitary confinement must surely have driven the girl crazy. Even so, having Mary in the same cage had its drawbacks. He had to keep a watchful eye on that young Fennett. He even had to keep a watchful eye on Boyle, the old goat. Mary screamed. Hawkins jerked into complete wakefulness. He could see the pale form of Mary. On this world, it was never completely dark at night. And on the other side of the cage, the forms of Fennett and Boyle. He got hastily to his feet, stumbled to the girl's side.
What is it?
I don't know. Something small with sharp claws. It ran over me.
Oh, that was only Joe.
Joe?
I don't know exactly what he or she is.
I think it's definitely a he.
What is Joe?
Well, he must be the local equivalent to a mouse, although he doesn't look like one. He comes up through the floor somewhere to look for food. We're trying to tame him.
You encourage the brute? I demand that you do something about him at once. Poison him or trap him. Now.
Tomorrow.
Now!
Tomorrow.
The capture of Joe proved to be easy. Two flat baskets, hinged like the valves of an oyster shell, made the trap. There was bait inside, a large piece of the fungus. There was a cunningly arranged upright that would fall at the least tug at the bait. Hawkins, lying sleepless on his damp bed, heard the tiny click and thud that told him that the trap had been sprung. He heard Joe's indignant chitterings, heard the tiny claws scrabbling at the stout basket work. Mary Hart was asleep. He shook her.
We've caught him.
Then kill him.
But Joe was not killed. The three men were rather attached to him. With the coming of daylight, they transferred him to a cage that Hawkins had fashioned. Even the girl relented when she saw the harmless ball of multicolored fur bouncing indignantly up and down in its prison. She insisted on feeding the little animal, exclaimed gleefully when the thin tentacles reached out and took the fragment of fungus from her fingers. For 3 days, they made much of their pet. On the fourth day, beings whom they took to be keepers entered the cage with their nets, immobilized the occupants, and carried off Joe and Hawkins.
Well, I'm afraid it's all hopeless. He's gone the same way.
They'll have him stuffed and mounted in some museum, won't they?
No, they couldn't.
Well, I'm afraid they could.
Abruptly, the hatch at the back of the cage opened. Before the three humans could retreat to the scant protection supplied by a corner, a voice called,
"It's all right. Come on out."
And Hawkins walked into the cage. He was shaved, and the beginnings of a healthy tan had darkened the pallor of his skin. He was wearing a pair of trunks fashioned from some bright red material.
"Come on out. Our hosts have apologized very sincerely, and they have more suitable accommodation prepared for us. Then, as soon as they have a ship ready, we're to go pick up the other survivors."
"Now, Hawkins, wait just a moment. Put us in the picture, will you? What made them realize that we were rational beings?"
Hawkins' face darkened, and he said,
"Only rational beings put other beings in cages."
Heard a story titled The Cage, written by Bertram Chandler. It appeared first in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction for June of 1957. This is Michael Hansen speaking, reading with me this time, Ward Paxton and Mindy Ratner. Technical production for MindWebs by Leslie Hilsenhoff. MindWebs comes to you from WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.